We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land in which we record this podcast today, the Arakwal people of the Bundjalung Nation, and pay our respects to elders past and present.
It's my turn. It was my turn 3 pregnancies ago.
There's no heartbeat yet.
There's no sperm.
I'll do anything. I just want so much to be a mother. There's a line. There's a line. And we did a transfer, 1 embryo in each surrogate. I have learnt that I am so freaking amazing. Families come together in many different ways and we need to normalise this.
Have sex and get pregnant. It's that easy, right?
Not for 1 in 6 of us. From the makers of Beyond the Bump, we, Sophie, Jade and La, bring you Behind the Bump,
a place to share stories and shed light on miscarriage, IVF, infertility and more.
So if you're trying to conceive,
or if your friend is doing IVF,
if you just love a moving story,
then Behind the Bump is the podcast for you.
And we're back again for part 2 of Dr. Timmy. Dr. Timmy obviously speaks way too much, but we also can't get enough of all his knowledge. So, La, take it away with what we're discussing.
Yeah, well, look, as we imagined, you guys absolutely frothed over the episode last week. Dr. Timmy, I could listen to all day personally. I find it so bloody interesting. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Timmy. We are going to be today getting into more of your questions and our questions around fertility, infertility, trying to conceive, and IVF itself.
He's like white noise.
But better, way better.
We're going to move on to IVF. The question that I have regarding age and where we're at the moment with, you know, women obviously falling pregnant at a later age, as younger women, should we be freezing our eggs as a preventative measure?
I think the answer to your question is that I don't think we should fall into the trap of overthinking.
Yeah.
And over medicalizing things. So somebody, let's say 24, going to the doctor and saying, I want to be checked for everything because I don't want to have a baby till I'm 34. And she has no medical history, has a regular menstrual cycle or is on the pill. You know, I think we have to accept that in life we may come across medical hurdles and we can't, in a preventative way,
yeah,
avoid everything.
I think it's important to discuss.
Yes.
I think it's really unwise to go for help and say, oh, I'm 44 years of age and I've been trying to get pregnant for 15 years.
Yeah.
And did it occur to you to come, say, 14 years ago?
Yes.
When you'd been trying for a year. So I think that there are extremes of leaving it too late. But I think that there are extremes of going in too early. And I'll give you an example of that. A lot of people are going to their GP and being tested for their AMH or anti-Müllerian hormone and then getting a relatively low result and then panicking that their fertility is now compromised and that they need to freeze eggs or they need to have a baby soon because they've got a low egg reserve. And whilst it would take hours to go through every scenario of anti-Müllerian hormone level, a couple of things I will say is, first of all, remember what I said, egg quality is more about your age than AMH is more about quantity. So if you are 24, I'm very confident, although I can't prove it, that you'll have good quality eggs. And so AMH has been referred to as the anxiety-making hormone. When I meet GPs, and the thing they always want to talk about is the management of AMH levels because it's caused them so much grief in their practices, people having an AMH and then worrying about the result. One of the most important situations with regard to egg freezing is people actually freezing their eggs because they're about to encounter something that could significantly affect their future fertility, like chemotherapy or invasive surgery. So let's be very careful to separate out situations where freezing eggs is to freeze eggs for the future because you know you're about to confront something that yes. will reduce your fertility over freezing eggs for the future because you're concerned you may be delaying trying to have babies and maybe leave freezing the eggs a little bit till you're more clear on what you want to do with your future fertility and not panic about that.
If a couple is at home trying to conceive spontaneously, at what point do you say is a good time to move to IVF in terms of like either their age or number of years trying?
Yeah, well, even the question, how long should I try naturally before I have investigations, is impossible to answer in that, remember I said egg sperm plumbing. So with eggs, if somebody has a cycle that's 28 days on the dot every month, well, from the point of view of eggs, that person is either on the pill or they're ovulating. So no test is required, no blood test, nothing, because they're ovulating.
Mm. There's
no way you could have a cycle like that. Whereas if somebody went 3 or 4 months at a time without having periods and has no cycle, and perhaps that predated them even starting trying, well, clearly don't delay going and seeking help because clearly you need something to get your cycle. Mm. And similarly, if your partner has had an undescended testes and surgery for that or lost a testes due to an injury or a torsion or something like that, don't delay getting that tested. And if you've tested positive for chlamydia in the past, or being told at a previous ultrasound that there was some abnormality in the pelvis, don't put that off. So I think it's impossible to set timelines without taking into account what the history is. And it would be better to say to people, if you think you might need some tests to check things, don't hesitate to step forward. You don't have to qualify for them. So yeah. If think your cycle's all over the place, or you're worried that you've got polycystic ovaries, or you're worried your partner's semen analysis might be abnormal, for goodness sake, just go and get it tested. It's not like other medical systems where you have to sort of fulfill all the criteria to have the test or the treatment. Just go and have it.
This could be a really stupid question, but is it more common for men to have sperm issues versus women with egg issues?
Look, the difficulty with a sperm issue is that an ejaculate could contain 1 billion sperm, which is a number
Jeez.
That is...
You'd think you'd land one, wouldn't you?
No human can comprehend that number. No, seriously, like even... You know, like even scientists and that can't fully appreciate like how many a billion is. So that kept in mind, you have to be very careful about what you look upon as sort of abnormal and normal in semen analysis. So I'll give you an example. If you did a study and you said that a group of cyclists had a sperm count of 40 million per mil, and then they stopped cycling and then they didn't warm their testes up and the average was 60 million per mil. I argue that didn't make them more fertile. It just put their sperm count up a bit. Like that's the 40 million per mil was perfectly fertile and the 60 million per mil is fertile. So when you're talking about male contribution to conceiving, very rarely is the sperm count zero. It does happen, but it's rarely zero. It's always these shades of grey. So if somebody's sperm count is 12 million per mil, that is abnormal, but it's still 12 million.
Yeah.
Mm.
And if someone's motility is 25%, that's low, but if you count the 25% times the number of sperm, that's still millions of motile sperm. And especially with the morphology where you're looking at the normal sperm, well, like up to 96% of the sperm can look abnormal and that's acceptable.
Mm.
So this is a production line that's just throwing out sperm at a very low quality control, but that's offset by the fact that It's such massive numbers. So if a person has normal forms of, say, 8% and someone's is 4%, that sounds like half as many normal sperm, but you're still dealing in tens of millions of sperm. So in a normal ovulatory cycle, a woman will ovulate one egg. And if they were to have intercourse, say, five times during that cycle, there might be 2 billion sperm and one egg who are trying to create the pregnancy. So we're talking about this astronomical imbalance of importance. And that's what I don't want to confuse people or have numbers running through people's heads that frighten them, but it just shows you how wary you have to be of what sounds right and what might help, because that sounds like a good idea, and the realities of the biology of this. One of the common misconceptions, and I love the word misconception when you're talking about fertility, is that you have to save up and try and get the timing right to conceive. And I'm not criticizing people, and I'm not being mean here, but, you know, the number of people who are trying to conceive using LH surge detection kits, apps, temperature charts, mucus change monitoring, in other words, ovulation prediction, and then they're having intercourse at this ideal time. So they're basically turning what was a biology exercise into a chemistry experiment. What would be much better would be to have intercourse more frequently, because the myth arises from the fact that when you do a semen analysis, you abstain for 4 days before doing the semen analysis. But that was simply to standardize the test so that everyone doing the semen analysis is on the same playing field. In conceiving, you will be more fertile if you have intercourse more often, not just from a timing point of view, but because the fresher ejaculate is better quality sperm. And to clarify that, we're recently reviewing our advice in IVF about when a patient comes in to have an egg collection. Obviously, on the day of the egg collection, the partner provides a sperm sample, if it's a couple, and then we would fertilize the eggs with that sample. Well, we're reviewing whether we should be recommending that, yes, the partner provides a sample on the day, but recommending that he should have ejaculated within the last 48 hours before that, preferably 1 to 2 days before, so that the specimen on the day is a better quality specimen.
Yeah.
So one message to take home from this would be, I understand the interest in understanding your cycle, and I respect that, but don't understand your cycle at the expense of having intercourse more frequently. And I don't mean that in a blokey, inappropriate way. I mean that in an actual fertility way.
Incredible. Glad I asked the stupid question.
No, that was great. It actually piqued my interest just in the idea then of size of things that we're talking about. Like you talking about the amount of semen in an ejaculate. How big is an egg compared to one semen? Like pretend an egg is an orange. How big is a semen next to it?
Yeah, well, you know, so that I don't sound like I'm winding you up, an egg is 27 times the size of a sperm. So I'll give you the answer straight up. But that's something I tell a lot of people now, because why have we been able to freeze sperm for over 60 years? And when you freeze an ejaculate of sperm, you might freeze a billion, or let's say half a billion. And yet, we've only recently been able to successfully freeze eggs, and even in a really successful stimulation cycle might get 15 eggs, which is an incomparable difference. Well, it's because eggs are the biggest cell in the human body. They have a very big cytoplasm, which you may remember from school biology, is like the fluid around a cell.
Definitely not.
And sure. In that cytoplasm, there is apparatus that help with the function of the cell, you know, mitochondria, things like that. And so when you freeze an egg and then thaw it, there's the risk of icicles forming in the fluid component of the cell, which damages the cell. Whereas when you freeze sperm, because they look like a little tadpole, they've got so little cytoplasm, they're very resilient to be frozen and then thawed out again. And that's why vitrification of eggs, which is freezing eggs, has taken so long to develop, because they're actually an extremely delicate and difficult cell to freeze. So, the answer to your question is they're 27 times bigger.
Wow. I had no idea that that was our biggest cell.
That's great. That no wonder so much can kind of go wrong with it, you know?
Yeah, well, interestingly, talking of egg reserve, you actually have your biggest egg reserve when you're a fetus.
Yes, you have said this before.
At about 20, 24 weeks of pregnancy, you've got more eggs than you were born with.
Isn't that incredible?
What for?
It's inside you. So when you're pregnant and you're carrying a female.
All cells have a built-in lifespan. That's called apoptosis, or programmed cell death. So each cell in your body, some cells might last 24 hours, some may last a lifetime if you live to 100. And eggs have a built-in lifespan. So of those eggs that were in the ovary as a fetus, some of them will, like, and it's not a very nice term, but like expire.
Yeah,
and then
die.
In women, most of the eggs that they have at puberty will have expired by 50 years of age. And that's why I'll make an important point there, is that people worry about fertility treatments if they've got a low egg reserve. The stimulating your ovaries may use up your eggs. So I've already got not many eggs, and now you go and stimulate me to make lots of follicles. Won't I lose my eggs? Well, I'll put it to you this way. If somebody at, say, 13 to 14 years of age went on the pill before she had her first period and stayed on the pill till she was 51, and therefore, strictly speaking, should not have used one egg in her body, because she won't have ovulated and she won't have recruited follicles to go into the ovulatory cycle. If she stops the pill at 51, she'll still have her menopause at exactly the same time as if she'd ovulated, had IVF, had one ovary removed, had 15 children, had no children, whatever.
They just expire.
Because you didn't use them up, they just had a lifespan.
It reminds me, I remember, and this is my naivety at the time, but when I fell pregnant with twins that were the type of twins that were due to hyperovulation, and we miscarried them. And I remember that was one of my questions was for my specialist was like, if I'm hyperovulating, am I using up all of my eggs? And I remember him just saying like, absolutely not. Like, your eggs are expiring all the time. It's not just every ovulation that you use one.
And that's a conversation I have commonly with people, because this concern about low egg reserve and then how can I preserve what I've got, well, that's built in. So if someone says, oh, going on the pill will protect your egg reserve, strictly speaking, that's not correct. One thing we didn't cover with recurrent miscarriage is that just if you do get investigated for recurrent miscarriage, there's three major categories for the investigation of recurrent miscarriage. The first category is anatomy. So in other words, is there a septum in the uterus? Is there a polyp or fibroid in the uterine cavity? Is there some sort of anatomical abnormality that would be leading to an increased chance of miscarriage? Now, whilst that's not very common, it certainly can happen. The second category is to check the genetic makeup of both the male and female contributing to the pregnancy. And as I said earlier, 46 chromosomes in 23 pairs. Some people have what's called a balanced translocation, so that it, and that could be male or female, because remember, they're both contributing 23 chromosomes. And their total genetic makeup is the normal amount of 23 chromosomes paired. However, when they split it into two sets of 23, a little bit too much can go one way and a little bit too little go the other way. Thus, it's unbalanced. So one of the investigations for recurrent miscarriage is to check the karyotype, the same as you do for a pregnancy to check the sex. And then the third category is, I'll call it inflammatory markers. So in other words, they're commonly, and people may have heard of things like antiphospholipid antibodies, anti-nuclear antibodies, and then under anti-nuclear antibodies, there's a number of other categories. And just in case there's people listening who've been told they've got a positive anti-nuclear antibody, let me reassure you that in the majority of cases, that is not significant. And it's, if the anti-nuclear antibody is positive, you then check others to see if subcategories are positive. And then the fourth area, which I didn't add in because it's controversial, is to do a clotting screen. Has the person got some sort of blood clotting abnormality? That's controversial because we don't really feel that those blood clotting abnormalities contribute greatly to miscarriage or fertility. However, if you've been checked for them, I feel that's a perfectly legitimate thing to check while you're doing the testing. And most importantly, when you're doing the testing, don't hope something gets found. Hope they're all normal, because as much as you may desperately want an explanation, you want all those things to be normal, because for your long-term well-being, it's much better to be sat down and told, look, I've done all the tests and they're all normal, because it's going to mean you're more likely to get pregnant on your own and you're less likely to have future problems as a result of any of those things.
Great. That's a really good reframe, because I feel like that is something a lot of women and men struggle with hearing, is like unexplained. But yeah, you're right. It is good news. You were talking before about freezing sperm, freezing eggs. We had a lot of people asking, what is better in terms of embryo transfer? Is fresh thought to be better? Is frozen thought to be better? What has a better rate of survival?
In an ideal situation, you would use fresh sperm where possible. But a lot of situations where we're freezing sperm, it's not an ideal situation. And so, of course, in donor sperm, that's all frozen and then thawed to be used, whether that's for IVF or for intrauterine insemination. And, you know, I would say where it's possible and good quality sperm will be obtained, use a fresh sample. And for any of the other categories, frozen is fine. And when they thaw the sperm, remember, we've said many times we're dealing with a lot of sperm, or even in cases where we're not dealing with a lot of sperm, you know, the embryologist, let's say for micro injection of an egg, and we all know that sort of classic IVF photo of an egg with the needle going into it. So that's micro injection. They would always pick the most motile, normal looking sperm to micro inject into that egg.
I have a bit of a weird question, so bear with me. Ooh. But I've heard in IVF there's talk about like different quality grading of embryos. And when I've heard it talked about, it's in relation to like whether it will be a successful transfer, whether it will stick, whether it will stay. But when we're looking at the grading of embryos and say there's like a poor quality embryo, does that also relate to, say, that child does grow and come out into the world? Does that child have, like, does it mean something about its health? Do you know what I mean?
Or it's behavior.
Not behavior.
That is not a weird question. That's a great question. And yes. I'll answer in two parts. So first of all, no. The makeup of the pregnancy is the DNA payload. So if you've conceived, you conceive. So an abnormal looking embryo right back at that stage, because you're talking about an embryo at 4 to 5 days of existence. And that embryo may have looked abnormal then, but you look at it 12 hours later and it looks a lot better or it looks a lot worse. So you're only looking at an embryo at a moment in time. So no, having being told, oh, it's a grade C embryo and we're putting it back does not mean getting a grade C baby.
Child.
So absolutely no. But going back to the first part of what you said is, let me make this 100% clear. All IVF is audited independently and there is no avoiding that. So it doesn't matter which IVF group you're going to, all their transfers are being recorded and the number of pregnancies calculated and the success rates determined. So you will not have a transfer of a poor quality embryo that can't produce a pregnancy because it's self-defeating for that IVF person to do that because they will ruin their own success rate.
Reputation.
So even though it might sound like, oh, I'll placate someone by giving them a transfer, no, that's just moving the disappointment 9 days further down the track at the pregnancy test. It's better just to bring forward the disappointment and say, no, we don't have an embryo for transfer.
And they're not under like a financial reward for doing more transfers?
No. An egg collection and transfer is included in what's called the global fee, and there is no financial reward for doing or not doing the transfer. It may be if the patient isn't covered by health insurance and has to pay to come in to have a transfer, it will save them that expense, but it wouldn't make any difference to the IVF people. So number one, IVF people would not transfer embryos that weren't a solid chance of creating a pregnancy. The other thing is the grading, as I mentioned before, is on that moment in time. So embryos are, the cells are dividing extremely rapidly. And, you know, a blastocyst might appear, that's a day five embryo, might appear one way now, and then in 2 hours' time might have hatched and look like something far more progressed. But there was no, like, that was just the moment that you looked at them. So, no, don't worry about the grading. If they've frozen the embryo or they're offering to put it back, that's an embryo that's believed to be capable of producing a pregnancy. Let me reassure you.
So when they're grading the embryo and they tell you that and people come out and share their stories about, oh, you know, I don't think it's a good grade, so we're not sure, you're literally saying that's just at that point in time when they were doing it.
We avoid, where I work, we avoid talking about gradings because it's just, it's really boils down to, is this embryo appropriate to transfer or not appropriate to transfer? And then the other embryos, let's say you're having a transfer in a fresh cycle and there are other embryos, are the other embryos appropriate to freeze or not? That's the answer. So whether it's A, B, or C, that's just making it harder for people to understand.
Yeah.
And that's why we avoid using gradings. And instead of saying, oh, your embryo is a grade this or a grade that, I'm not saying no one's ever been told the grading because they may directly ask, but I'm just saying it's not part of the dialogue we'd encourage. What we do is show them a photo of the embryo. There's your embryo that we're about to put back. And these are the characteristics of it that are the reason why we believe we should put it back. You know, and since blastocyst transfers came about, because when I started in IVF, we did embryo transfers on day 3, sometimes even day 2. So you might be doing an embryo transfer of a 6-cell embryo. Sometimes by the time the embryologist came down to the room for the transfer, they'd say, oh, I just looked at it under the microscope, it's 8 cells now. percentage divided. And so that person, when they were told in the room before the transfer, oh, you've got a, you know, a 6 cell and an 8 cell and a 4 cell, that's just that moment, because the 6 cell might have become an 8 and the 4 cell might have become 12 in 2 hours. Like, who knows? So don't overinterpret these so-called gradings. But that's all gone. Now day 3 is gone and it's now day 5. But even in day 5, there's numerous stages of where it might be just before or just after at that stage.
Is it true that you can actually watch the process, like it's being filmed in the lab?
Some of the incubators now have built-in video microscope technology. So that means that the embryologist can review the embryo basically without opening the door of the incubator. Mm. Because if you look at the variables that might affect success rate, even a microscopic change in temperature, pH, vibration, movement. So if you can minimize every variable, we feel that that, you know, should maximize the chance of success. So looking at embryos in the incubator with a microscope is actually possible now.
The grading that we were just talking about, is that distinct from like PGT testing? Is that a different
Absolutely.
Thing?
Absolutely. So that's right. The appearance of the embryo. And look, I'm not an embryologist, but there are numerous qualities that are looked at to determine a grading and indeed to determine whether or not to transfer the embryo. Like, you think about it, when they thaw a frozen embryo and say the embryo hasn't survived the thaw, how do they look at an embryo and know it's alive or not? It doesn't have a heartbeat. Look, it's just the cleverness of this is just crazy. No, PGT is when you take cells from the embryo and you then perform a genetic test on them. So that might be looking for a specific problem. So you've got like a probe that you can look at the DNA on the cells in the embryo, looking for, say, the cystic fibrosis gene, because there's lots of them. But So the patient's a carrier of the Delta 508 cystic fibrosis gene. All right, we put that marker in. No, the embryo isn't carrying that gene or two of them. Or it might be to do what's called aneuploid screening, which is where you're just looking, this embryo has 46 chromosomes in 23 pairs. That embryo has 47 chromosomes, so that one's abnormal. But do always be careful that with embryo biopsy, whether it's for the number of chromosomes or whether it's for a specific abnormality like cystic fibrosis, spinal muscular atrophy, Duchenne's, whatever it is, there's thousands. There's three possible results. There's normal, there's abnormal, and there's inconclusive. And so if anyone is going to do embryo biopsy, it's very important to counsel them that a very difficult scenario is to be told there is an embryo or embryos where you're actually not quite sure. Do you put that back or don't you put it back? So embryo biopsy is not the cure for all problems. And it's been used a lot in recurrent miscarriage under the belief that, of course, if you put an embryo back that's been tested that came back with 46 chromosomes, then clearly, theoretically, you'll reduce the risk of miscarriage. But you've put the patient through a lot of steps and a lot of expense to get to that point. Mm. Also, what if you get embryos and one of the embryos it's inconclusive? Then that poor person who's already gone through all this trauma with miscarriage is thinking, well, do I put it back or don't I put it back? People have to be ready for those situations.
What are the stats around IVF success rates?
Well, they're usually categorized into, you know, under 35, 35 to 39 and 40 and over. And with day five transfers of embryos in people under 35, and remember, a 20-year-old is different than a 35-year-old, you know, success rates are approaching 50% per transfer. Incredible success rates that back when I started in IVF over 30 years ago, it was never imagined that success rates like that would ever be achieved because we didn't do day five transfers. So success rate was much lower back then. Then, interestingly, the category from 35 to 39 in the most recent couple of audits of all of Australia's IVF has been one of the areas where there's been improvement, because the lower age pregnancy rate was always really good, or not always, but has for years been really good. But there's been improvement in those slightly older patients. And then, of course, beyond 40, the success rate sadly tails off very quickly. And, you know, that's a difficult area of IVF, you know, because you not only are you getting less pregnancies per X number of transfers, remember, if a woman goes through for a cycle of IVF at 30 compared to 40, then hopefully the 30-year-old will get a lot more eggs, a lot more embryos, a lot more blastocysts, and then have an embryo transfer and have frozen blastocysts to go back to. So the chances of achieving a pregnancy from one cycle of IVF involves multiple chances. Whereas if somebody comes through for IVF at 40 and don't get as many eggs and don't get as many embryos, therefore don't get as many transfers and chances to be pregnant. So you've got to take into account the lower chance per transfer plus less transfers per cycle.
At what point does IVF just become like a bit cruel to have a couple keep doing? Is there a certain number of cycles or transfers that you personally would say, like, we have to look at something else? This isn't, you know, healthy to keep going.
Well, I think that couples would vary in their determination to keep going. And that might be for physical, like side effects. It might be for psychological, you know, which is very important, or it might be for financial reasons. And then obviously there might be some variation in practitioners in terms of encouraging to stop or encouraging to keep on. There are some treatments where a cycle occurs that just sort of, it just sends the message to stop. You know, like no eggs were retrieved, no embryos were formed, and that the couple or the patient may say, look, I accept now that I don't want to go through this anymore. And other times, well, obviously we hope that the commonest reason to stop IVF treatment is the family's complete. And we'd love that always to be the case. But, look, there are many, many difficult conversations that have to be had with people undergoing IVF treatment. And then really the main alternative to IVF treatment in a couple who or a person who isn't getting pregnant is whether it's appropriate to suggest some form of donor treatment, like donor eggs or donor embryos.
There's just so many possibilities now, which is just, you know, obviously it's overwhelming when you're in this situation, but at the same time, it does give you so many bouts of hope of thinking, well, if this avenue doesn't take, perhaps we have this one. And it, I guess it keeps you in that hopeful, positive mindset that you perhaps will eventually end up with a baby.
But another message that comes out almost like around that is don't put too much faith in IVF to put off having a baby. So if you are 35 and you're starting to think about having a family, but you know, and let's face it, lots of people have got other plans. They've got career things. They've got financial things. They've got personal, educational things that lead them to put off having a family. Do try and just keep a balanced approach to, you know, how much time is it going to be, and should I perhaps think about this in the scheme of how things are likely to pan out, rather than thinking, oh, plenty of people have IVF babies at 40, I'll just leave it till I'm 40, because it'll be heartbreaking if your heart is set on having a baby at 40 and it doesn't pan out that way.
Kimmy, absolutely. This has been the most incredibly educational, knowledgeable episode. So
Madison, I have
learned.
I have to ask you, beyond the bump, the mothership.
Yes. Yes.
Got one.
Taking
off.
Out of here.
Got one and two for episodes on this podcast thing. And I think number 7 as well.
Yes.
Yeah, the top
You're
episodes
everywhere.
On Apple Podcasts.
Yeah. Well, that's hurtful.
Why?
Because none of them were Dr. Timmy episodes.
If we looked back then, they probably were.
Timmy, you've just got to come back on. You can't just expect. You've got to come back and you've got to work harder for the fans. You watch this one
Let's
fly
see
off
what
the
this,
handle.
I feel like this is going to go gangbusters.
The other thing I need to update you on, and I'm just going to refer to my phone.
Here he goes. He's going on his Instagram stats, I bet.
You may recall when I did my first ever podcast with you guys.
Yeah.
That I was trying to get my followers
Same.
Up.
I knew he was going there. Yeah, where is sorry. It?
Now, I'm now on 979.
So close. Now, come on.
I put very, very little effort into my Instagram, but I feel that 1,000 is referred to as a cadet influencer.
Yes.
Do you think that's a good term?
I do. I like that. I'm actually very happy with that.
I'm being a cadet influencer.
Are we 21 followers off?
21 off.
Oh, come behind the bumpies. If you are out there listening, we've got Timmy. Is it? It's Timmy Chippen, isn't it?
Timmy Chippen.
That's all it is.
We'll put it in the show notes.
And it's pretty good because I'm only following 80.
And he's got really good gift ideas and he might share them with you or he might not.
Did you see my cubby house?
I know. It's a bloody ripper. He's pretty
beautiful.
Good.
It is.
Do you have photographic memory out of interest?
Actually, it's not as beautiful as that.
Oh.
It's not Sophie, everyone. It's Shimmy. And that's not Sophie either.
Right. For this audio platform, no one can see, but Timmy's holding up beautiful pictures of his family,
yes.
Which you can find on his Instagram.
You can. Well, is there any other words of wisdom before we leave you?
It was a bit of a double-edged sword, the Apple podcast rating thing, because I was happy for Soph, but I was a little bit aggrieved.
Yes, I know.
But I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by what happens after this one goes out.
You'll be back, all right?
And does this behind the bump have a different image?
Well, yeah, it has a different image, thanks for knowing. And also, if you are going to go gangbusters on this one, that's including Beyond the Bump. So
it's under the same
you're back
title.
On top again.
That's what's important.
No, I asked you a question. Do you have photographic memory?
Oh, goodness, no. I've got quite a good memory for anything I'm interested
in. Yeah, yeah.
Terrible memory for things I'm not interested in, but like footy scores and Hollywood premierships and watches, Porsches.
All right, I'm leaving you now. It has been wonderful. Would you like to see Pearl before you leave?
I'm coming up on Friday.
Oh, she's asleep.
Well, she's asleep anyway, so you don't get to.
Coming up on Friday.
You'll see her on
Friday, sweetheart.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Behind the Bump.
If you loved today's episode, you can head to our Facebook group, Behind the Bump, where you can join in the conversation, find support, and so much more. It's linked in the show notes.
Until next week.
Bye-bye.